But I did kind of, you know, elbow my way to some on-air jobs. So I started at BBC London Radio, then moved to TV as a producer mainly. And then I started doing, you know, the odd reporting and presenting. And it was when I was presenting bulletins and I'd done, I mean, I don't know, maybe a dozen, maybe around 20 shifts. And, you know, the emails would come because it's so long ago, there was no Twitter, but there was email. And I remember one email that said, "I don't pay my license fee to have the news read by a foreigner."
The first non-native English speaker to present a primetime news program on British television. Barbara Serra is a multilingual Italian-British journalist, TV news presenter, and writer with 20 years of experience working for major international news channels, including Al Jazeera English, Sky News, and the BBC. In 2019, Barbara was awarded a knighthood by the Italian government for her work in international journalism, and she has been recognized as one of the 20 most high-profile Italian women internationally by Elle magazine. Welcome to a new episode of When Power Podcast, and welcome, Barbara. It's truly an honor to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So I did a bit of a Google search, and I asked how many non-native English speaker journalists are in the UK, and the first result that appeared was your brilliant piece on Substack on the barriers faced by second language journalists in the UK. After that, there were many results from census, field studies, and researches, all highlighting a big lack of diversity and inclusion in the UK newsroom. And let's say that's not really a happy picture. But we are here today to bring a bit of light and some advice and tips to all the young journalists and even more senior that they are listening and watching us today. But before we do that, I just want to start from the beginning of your story, so to get to know you a little bit better and to discover why you decided to become a journalist and what were the first steps that you moved into the fields and, you know, just a look at the past.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question because I think whenever people look back, sometimes you try to not quite embellish the truth, but you think, oh yes, that was the moment when I had my epiphany. So I am Italian, as you mentioned, Italian born. I actually grew up in Denmark. My parents moved there. So from the ages of 8 to 18, I lived in Denmark, went to an international school, which is where I learned English. And that is also why I then decided to come to the UK, because back in my day, you know, I wanted to come to London. The unis, you know, it has to be said, were free at the time. I got in at a good uni in London, which is where I wanted to go. And so I came to the UK because I knew that I wanted to be a journalist. And I knew that if I wanted to be an international journalist, I had to be somewhere where people spoke English and where the main networks were headquartered. So when did I decide to become a journalist? I think I became aware of journalism. This is really going to date me, but the first Iraq war. So you're talking, you know, like the early 1990s. And I remember CNN was effectively, you know, the daddy of the news channels, the first ones that were reporting a war live, which I have to say something I have many issues with now, 30 years later. But I just remember watching it and falling in love with live broadcasting. And so I decided to become a journalist. But if I'm honest, I decided to become a broadcaster. And, you know, language was still, or rather than language, English was still something relatively new to me. Let's just say I did not sound then like what I sound like now, because I'd only learned it when I was about eight or nine. So I think it all kind of came together. I decided to become a journalist. I knew I was interested in international affairs and in current affairs, and I knew that I wanted to do it in English, because if you want to be an international broadcaster, there's really no choice there.
Exactly. And I have a curiosity. Do you remember the first story you covered?
Oh my gosh. Well, it was ridiculous. So the first story, I've got to say, the first story that kind of made me was, God rest his soul, the death of Pope John Paul II in Rome. And I was a reporter at Sky News, but that was really the story where I was sent. And because, you know, I spoke Italian and because I'm Catholic and kind of know my way around the Vatican, I was sort of like left there for a couple of months, which is the best thing you can have as a young reporter. I think the very first story was a much more local London story. I did two. One was about pollution on the Edgware Road, and the other one was about baby modeling in London, because apparently if you want your baby to be a model, you need to get like a certificate from the local council. Some councils were more effective than others. I can't believe I'm saying the story and telling it. And so, you know, depending on where you live, there was a postcode lottery about, about it. But I think I got it from the South London Press. So much for my investigative journalism, but it ended up on BBC London.
We always need to start somewhere.
Exactly.
No?
Well, pinching other people's stories, yeah.
And it's a good memory, you know, a funny one. I have a curiosity, one more. And how did a day in the life of a newsreader look like? Anything that you would like to share with us? Any behind the scenes?
Yeah, I mean, look, very different, obviously, to what my life is now. And I have to say, even though there'll always be a little bit that misses daily news. I left Al Jazeera in April 2022, and I don't work in newsrooms anymore. I think what I miss the most is the camaraderie and the chatting with other journalists and, you know, like sometimes animated discussions about the stories of the day and not agreeing and everyone being quite okay with not agreeing, because that's what journalists do, so no one takes offense. So a day in the life for me was, you know, it started early in the morning, even though I would present late at night. You're always plugged in, you know, news is a narrative. And so I'm not saying you always have to follow every tiny detail, but you do have to be plugged into the sort of the conversation, right? So I would start by listening to radio in the morning while I was going around doing my things, taking my son to school. And then I would go into the newsroom after lunch, again, find out what stories we were covering, watch on TV or speak to some of our correspondents to see, you know, what they were seeing, and chatting to the guest producers about the kind of guests that we wanted to get on, the kind of questions we wanted to ask them, go into makeup. So I used to look very different. I'd have like people that would straighten my hair and put makeup on professionally, and then go on air for 3 hours of live programming. And, you know, when you sat down, you never ever really knew what was going to happen. I remember the last big breaking news story that I did was the assault on Capitol Hill on January 6th in the States. And literally, like, you're sitting down and then that unfolds. So it was exciting, but I'll be honest, there are elements of it that I don't miss. Very relentless, and at Al Jazeera, a lot of, you know, horrific footage, of course, some of which you can't even show. But I did love it when I did it.
I kind of like almost picturing you moving around the studio. So very,
there's a lot of people. That's the thing. Like, I'm just a lady all made up talking to herself in a studio without everybody else. And that's that is the thing I miss the most.
It's a teamwork, no?
Oh, I mean, TV is all about that, especially outputting a program. Absolutely.
And you mentioned it that you left after 20 years, you left the news. And, you started a new journey that brought you to explore blogging through Substack, mm-hmm. and you launched this newsletter, News with a Foreign Accent. And this is the main reason why we are here today to have this conversation. And I would like to start from this particular point that you made in one of your posts. Language is a privilege. Why?
English is a privilege. Speaking English is a privilege, and that's a very strange thing to say in England, where we are right now, because of course English is the national language. People would go, well, hold on, why is speaking our language a privilege? And so I think there's a different dynamic to English in England, or, you know, the United Kingdom, and English as the international language. So even when Al Jazeera launched an international channel in 2006, height of the war on terror, 3 years after the war in Iraq, you know, a lot of tensions, if you will, between the Arab world and the Anglophone world, you know, what language did that channel launch in? Well, obviously English. So my point is that English is the language that connects us. We talk about an interconnected world. Well, that world is only interconnected if you speak English. You can only truly access the internet, and I mean, AI might change that a little, but you can only truly access the internet and a lot of what the world has to offer if you speak in English. So to me, speaking English is a privilege anywhere. So even speaking it as a third language is a privilege if you stay in whichever country, you know, if you're in Italy or any other part of the world, speaking English is a privilege because it opens up the world. Speaking it fluently, even more so. Speaking it as a native language Absolutely, because it just gives you, you know, especially if you're a journalist, language is your tool. You know, it's our skill. It's how we communicate. Every word matters the way that you understand or explain the world. So speaking it as a native language is a privilege. And I've like done a sort of accent hierarchy where, you know, English as in British, Southern England, posh, but not too posh. No one wants too posh anymore. Sort of like middle of the road. British English, as in Southern English, is probably top of the tree when it comes to accents. So that's my point, that English is a privilege when you look at it globally.
And what happened when you are a journalist and your first language is not English? How do you move around and how can you access this field that looks like very secluded and somehow, even from my experience, I got rejected a few interviews because I was not an English speaker. So, you know, how do you move around and how do you confirm your skills and your knowledge?
So I think there's two different things. First of all, remember that globally, there's about 1.5 billion people in the world that speak English. Mm. Around 500 million speak it as a native language. So, you know, Britain, Canada, the US, you know, Australia, New Zealand, etc. 1 billion people around the world will speak English as a second or third language. So the first thing I would say is that you're not the minority, you're the majority. The second thing I'll say, and this is personal, I never ever felt like a victim. You know, I think that there's dynamics there. So what I am trying to do now with the newsletter and another work around that, I do a lot of mentoring for a lot of younger journalists, is that I want to raise the issue because I also think, you know, diversity and inclusion isn't just about being fair. I mean, that's also, you know, there's 14.5 million foreign-born people living in the UK, so it'd be nice to hear from them. So it's about fairness and giving people a shot, but it's also about being representative of society. Mm. And you can say that of diversity and inclusion in every single sphere. You sort of should represent the audience that you're trying to serve. I would say with second language English speakers, there's two issues when it comes to journalism. One, as I mentioned, that language is our skill, you know, and you can be as, you know, open-minded when it comes to diversity and inclusion as you like, but you cannot compromise on clarity. You cannot put someone on air, and believe you me, you would not want to be on air without full command of the language that you're going to use. So we're going to talk about accent later, but the first stumbling block, because I do think it is a disadvantage, and I think there's no shame in calling it that, it is language. You know, how you control and use your language, especially in something like journalism, where you'll be thrown at all sorts of stories. You'd be doing a crime story one day, international relations another, you know, COVID, all the medical terms. So it could be anything. So one is the mastery of language. Second is about accents. And this is interesting because, you know, not that long ago, there were a lot of English accents that weren't really allowed. Well, I mean, allowed is a strong word, but you didn't hear them on TV. All sorts of reasons. You know, some local just sound that just didn't sound like the mainstream kind of, you know, again, that posh but not too posh kind of BBC English. I think that has changed enormously for the better. And I think now, look, you know, I don't think the situation is perfect, but I do think that compared to when I started, things are a lot better. I remember a friend of mine from Birmingham, when I started getting on air at the BBC, went, flipping heck, Babs. You know, you got on air as a foreigner before I did as a Brummie, which, you know, he had a point. I think the difference with foreign accents is just that. And people really bristle at the word foreign. But I think for people that come here as an adult, you know, I came here as a 19-year-old by choice. It is obvious that I was formed elsewhere. I've been here 30 years. I'm now British as well. But I appreciate I'll never be British the way that someone who was not just born here necessarily, but grew up here in the formative years. So the thing is that when you sound foreign, you sound just that. Foreign, separate. And I think news is about trust, and trust is tribal. And so there is a barrier, right? And it also has to be said, especially with a lot of Europeans, which is one of the things that I focus on, a lot of the European migration was quite transient. So people would come for a couple of years. And, you know, journalism is all about understanding the people that you're reporting on. And especially, you know, and I say this, you know, as someone who, I mean, not that I've never left London, I have left London, but I think a lot of people that come from abroad like to be in places where there's also other foreigners, so you don't feel so othered. So a lot of us, in fairness, never really go outside London, or, you know, not that often. And so you do get a kind of bubble. And I think if you're going to work in broadcasting, certainly, but any kind of journalism, you have to know the audience. If you haven't lived here that long, you just don't know the audience very well. You know, it's not it's just the way it is because you haven't grown up here. Sometimes you see things as an outsider that could help. But so you see, there's a lot of stumbling blocks. So I don't think that there's editors in newsrooms going, we're going to keep those foreigners out and not give them any jobs. And in fairness, I was given a lot of chances, right? So I did have issues, but they were particular ones. But there is a sort of barrier there, and it starts to matter. It really started to bother me after Brexit. Because I thought, you know what? There's 5 million EU citizens here, and I'm not going to start the whole Brexit conversation. But if you think you've had a tough time, you know, hold the beer of all the people who literally, like, for years were wondering what their right to continue living here was. And it really hurt me how they didn't really have a voice. Like a couple pieces here and there, but it was always like outsiders telling their stories, because there are very, very few EU journalists, you know, EU kind of residents here that are journalists in UK media. But the numbers are astounding, you know. 6 million people applied for settled status. 6 million.
That's a big number.
Well, take it with a pinch of salt. You're looking at 5 million. That's a lot of people.
So that's, you're living out of the narrative and you're not talking about their stories. You're not, you know.
Listen, again, I think there's complications. I think that there is a desire within newsrooms, certainly, to be more inclusive because it makes sense for them. I mean, it's not like necessarily, maybe it is also out of the goodness of their hearts, but it is because the more inclusive you are, the more you represent society, the more viewers you will have, right? But there's certain complications there when it comes to foreign-born people, especially foreign-born that came here as adults. So what I'm trying to do is just raise awareness of that.
I mean, this is great. What you said about the accent brought me back to an internship I did in Italy. And it's funny because Italy, I was born and raised there, so Italian is my first language. But I was questioned because of my accent. So I'm from Sardinia. And when I speak in Italian, maybe I don't have that standardized TV, radio accent. And they didn't want me to read the news because it was not aligned with, you know,
so look, that's it. Having said that, though, two of the most high-profile program presenters in Italy are from Sardinia as well. I think, listen, I also bizarrely did some mentoring for a girl, for a woman, young woman in Wales, whose first language was Welsh, but then wanted to broadcast in English. So I think you have an element of that here as well. I think regional accents, are, you know, sometimes present challenges because sometimes they'll be difficult to understand. Yeah. And that is, I think that applies to every accent. There is a difference between being more inclusive and just saying, look, not everyone has to sound the same, but sometimes certain accents can be harder to understand. And that, you know, that is a hard one to square. It's a hard circle to square in any kind of communication. So, and I've certainly done a lot of work on my voice. I like to think I'm not trying to sound like something that I'm not, but I have done a lot of work on my voice to achieve the clarity. To me, the word, if you're going to remember one word out of this conversation, clarity. Mm. Doesn't matter what your accent is, because your accent is you, you know? None of us speak the way we speak by coincidence. But I do think if you're going to get into the business of communicating to people, and people will be from all over the world, or, you know, from, you know, contexts that are different to yours, then clarity is kind of non-negotiable.
If you are enjoying this conversation, make sure you follow us on all social media platforms at WenPowerUK, and you subscribe to our podcast channel on Spotify and YouTube. So, Barbara, how was it to have an accent and being a newsreader in your experience?
To have a foreign accent.
So,
look, I think my experiences were very different, different, obviously, in British media and international media. And when we're talking about British media, we're kind of talking 20 years ago, right? So a lot has changed. I think it was always a barrier. It was something that othered me. It was something that made me stand out. And I always remember people, sometimes I would kind of rebel and say, but, you know, I also represent, you know, the European communities, and in fairness, in those years, that's when European migration was increasing to this country. And I was always told diversity isn't for you. And I get that, you know, I understand. In 2003, I totally understand that that wasn't the priority. You know, I didn't represent a group that needed to be integrated or that had had disadvantages. But I did kind of, you know, elbow my way to some on-air jobs. So I started at BBC London Radio, then moved to TV as a producer mainly. And then I started doing, you know, the odd reporting and presenting. And it was when I was presenting bulletins and I'd done, I mean, maybe a dozen, maybe around 20 shifts. And, you know, the emails would come because it's so long ago, there was no Twitter, but there was email. Mm-hmm. And I remember one email that said, I don't pay my license fee to have the news read by a foreigner. And I was taken off air after that. And it was made pretty clear that it was because of that. Now, look, zero victimhood for me in the sense that no one is owed a job on television. Nobody's owed a job reading the news. And it was obviously a barrier because then it happened again. Then I went to Sky News as a reporter. And, you know, I got given loads of chances, but the accent was always sometimes, especially working on domestic stories. So the second I did international stories, bizarrely, it's almost an asset, isn't it? It's like credentials. Oh, look, I am international. But in domestic stories, it was a barrier, again, I think, because of trust and credibility. People think, well, she doesn't know what, you know, how can she, who obviously sounds foreign born, know what my situation is? And, you know, journalism is about trust. So then Sky were very generous and made me do quite a lot of voice training, which I still carry to this day. I mean, it changed my voice and made me a much better broadcaster. I think when I left domestic news, I gave up any kind of attempt at trying to sound English, but I kept the clarity and I kept a lot of the things that it taught me, you know, about breathing and diction and all these things. And then when I mean, it was at Channel 5 when I was the sort of first, you know, second language, non-native, whatever, presenter of a main primetime terrestrial TV bulletin. And even there, I did it for 3 months. It was a trial out and it didn't work. And I remember the boss at the time saying, you know, a third of the audience thinks it's okay. A third doesn't care. A third thinks, yeah, whatever, it's quite nice. But a third really don't like it. He said, it's a real barrier for them. And he was very honest. He said, I can't ignore a third of the audience, nor should he, you know? And so obviously when I went to international news, it was different. But my argument is that actually, even in international news, if you look at what we call the international channels, it goes back to that idea that language is your tool. So when we think of international news, we think of English language news, right? So it's an issue there as well. Accents matter a little less, but again, you tune into TV, international TV channels, especially the kind of main ones. And, you know, I bet you everyone sounds native. Don't look at the diversity on screen. Listen, right?
To the voice.
Well, it'll be American accents, it'll be Australian accents, it'll be British accents. And of course, you're talking about hugely multicultural nations. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying everyone's like white and samey, but the voice ties them together. And that means that what you are getting is the Anglophone world's point of view that has a sort of very heavy, you know, imprint on what we consider the international narrative. And again, my work is about trying to just highlight the issue. It's not done on purpose. It's just a consequence of English being the global language. You know, I mean, American and British broadcasters are among the best in the world. So, and then you get the Al Jazeeras of this world.
Of course.
But yeah, to me, that's the issue.
And that's what brought you to write on...
Oh, no, I mean, I wanted to focus on topics. So I focus on this and I focus on neo-fascism as well a lot. So those are my two main topics. And then once you have the topics that you're trying to get to the bottom of, then whether it's a podcast or a Substack newsletter or a documentary or, you know, I just kind of wanted to step away from the grind of 24-hour news and being able to talk about everything, but not really have in-depth knowledge of much. So, yeah.
And how is the reaction of your readers of the newsletter? What are the comments, the
interaction? Well,
you get?
I mean, that I called it news with a foreign accent because it's more like one is having a slightly foreigner's take on what we could call mainstream news. But then, of course, all this work around language, and I was amazed. I mean, well, actually, do you know what? I wasn't amazed. I always suspected there'd be a lot of people that would empathize. But yeah, enormous feedback from all over the world. Some really sort of sad stroke funny stories sometimes, the way that people have been, you know, the way the impact their accent has had on their careers. And, you know, it's not just journalism. It's everything you need language for. So anyone who has to give a presentation, diplomacy, you know, language is key to everything we do.
It is. It is. And it keeps coming to my mind, clarity. I think I'm going to leave from here.
Clarity.
Because it's something that I notice even at work. If I listen to someone with a different accent speaking, and sometimes, as you say, it's hard to understand the meaning. And depending what the topic you're talking about, if I'm not really confident and I don't, you know, we are talking about something that maybe I'm not passionate or I don't read every day, it is really hard for me to keep the focus. So the struggle, it's obvious, but at the same time, I think maybe right now, compared to 20 years ago, we are at a stage where we, you know, some action and step forwards can be taken.
I mean, I think there's no way around improving your English, you know, as a second language speaker. There's so I think more acceptance of slightly different fields. But I'll tell you one story. My dad is no longer alive, but of course, with a daughter who was on various TV news channels, he was a TV news channel addict. And he liked Al Jazeera, but sometimes I'd catch him watching Sky News after I'd left. I'm like, what are you doing? How can you watch Sky? And he's like, and you know, my dad spoke English. He spoke businessman English, but he didn't speak it. You know, he didn't learn it as a child. So, you know, more properly second language English. And he said, no, I love Al Jazeera. He said, it's just that sometimes the people in Al Jazeera I find difficult to understand, whereas on Sky, because they all sound the same, it is easier for me to understand them. So that you get the great irony that actually, if you're a second language English speaker, especially if you're watching from a part of the world where they don't speak English in your country, the irony is that you will tune in better to the kind of English that you are used to, and that is the standard kind of either British or American English. So, yeah, so listen, that it goes back to, you know, this isn't about victimhood. This is about just trying to address an issue, which I think then has an impact on the narrative. Stories like the war in Ukraine. I mean, Al Jazeera was all about giving a different point of view about the war on terror. I mean, I do a lot of work on fascism and, of course, very different attitudes to World War II between the UK and the US that emerged as obviously the victors, but also didn't really have war on their soil. Mm-hmm. So the UK was bombed ferociously, but it didn't have invading forces. Compare that to continental Europe, where, you know, it was invaded, occupied, deportations, you know, it has those scars. And of course, the scars of Nazism and fascism. So you have a people that had to look in the mirror at the end of the war and think, you know, my goodness, how could that happen? So it's not just about, going back to the start, it's not just about inclusion, which is absolutely correct. You know, we should be more inclusive. It is also about the final product. It's about making it more reflective of the world, of your audience, of the international narrative.
I find also very inspiring that you decided, you know, that you're working currently with a lot of young journalists, mentoring, and you are raising awareness on the subject. So, what advice would you give to a young journalist that would like to access and start a career in journalism right now?
Don't worry too much about this, and figure out your passion. You know, work hard, consume media voraciously. You know, it took me a while to find my way, right? So I think a stint in general news, but I mean, I would say this because I'm a general news kind of background. I think a stint in general news will do you the world of good. But I do think, you know, look around for what you might have a passion for. Try to always challenge yourself. Always, I mean, if you've got 3 subscriptions, make sure that at least one is to a publication you don't agree with. Not someone that lies, but something that doesn't agree with you ideologically. So I would say that. And then look around and you know, say, you know, whenever you go into a meeting with a news editor, they always want to pick your brains for ideas and your energy and, you know, you're under. So look around. Don't. All the advice, you know, obviously I would say subscribe to my newsletter because I write about this extensively
and give advice.
But you know, more than that, remember it's about the journalism ultimately. Don't use this as an excuse. You know, there's a million setbacks. I'm telling you about the setbacks that I had. You'd get someone else on this chair to tell you a million other setbacks that they experienced. So, you know, I don't believe that there's many people that had like a career handed over to them on a platter. So don't focus on that. Just focus on the journalism.
And work hard. Work hard, read news, read more news. we are going towards the end of this conversation. I would like to ask you a question just because of the nature of WomenPower and the focus we have on gender equality, women, and especially women in leadership position. You moved around different newsroom, and how do you think was the state of women in leadership in the newsroom when you started and compared to now?
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of women in leadership. There was even, I mean, the head of the London Bureau of Al Jazeera, even in 2006, was a woman. But there's certainly a lot of women in key positions now and in the main network. So I don't think it's that. I think, look, it's a big question. I think from personal experience, you know, having a baby made a big difference to my career. But then again, my career is a bit odd, where there was a lot of travel involved. I did less of that. By choice, other people do, you know. But no, I would think women in leadership positions is a thing now. On TV, I mean, you always had women on TV, you know, for decades, but now you really see, you know, the main positions being taken up by women as well. So I think we're moving in the right direction. It's part of, you know, the whole, well, I don't want to say diversity because it's half the population. But yeah, and I do think, you know, the viewers also would expect that. It goes back to being inclusive to the audiences and giving the audience things that they are interested in. And if you don't highlight 50% of the population, well, you're not doing your job very well.
Exactly. You mentioned it, and I have a question on work-life balance that I think is going to resonate with a lot of the women are listening and watching us today. How do you handle being a mother and wanted to pursue a career in a newsroom? And I don't know, any advice, again, or any particular experience that you would like to share?
I think, and I can't speak for it, but I think in the newsrooms where I've worked, women have been given the choice, right? Because I think that's what you want. You know, we're all different, even assuming that all women are the same. And also, you know, a lot of us will have different pregnancies and maybe children with different needs, right? So it's, and so I think right now, women are allowed to choose. You know, you want to, I don't know, even do a lot of travel or possibly go to war zones pregnant, you know, before often, like I know at least one story in the past, this is 20 years back, where a woman didn't say she was pregnant in the early months because otherwise she wouldn't be sent to the war zones, right? So that used to happen. So I think now women are given the choice, which is important. And also, I mean, the advice is marry a man that understands it's called parenting. And so it's both. And, you know, perhaps, arguably, you know, when you're pregnant, depending, and then the early months, it might be slightly different. But that, you know, choose the father of your child wisely.
Is a teamwork even there?
Sorry?
Is a teamwork even there?
Oh, well, I mean, if otherwise of course, the balancing of the career becomes incredibly hard, yeah.
I want to go back to our Italian roots a bit and to see what are the differences that you... I know that you work all your life here in the UK as a news presenter, but I'm sure you also experience and you have knowledge of the media landscape in Italy. So what are the biggest differences that you notice, even when it comes to diversity and inclusion and also gender equality?
Okay, I mean, those are a lot of very big questions. So I would say that I noticed more differences 6 years ago or 10 years ago than I do now when it comes to the media landscape. I think that the idea of objectivity before anything else would be the biggest difference. Diversity and inclusion is just more of an issue, as in there is less of it in Italy. In some ways, that is because, especially when you think of Italy's ethnic minorities, because the kind of migration that Italy has seen is more recent. So you're only now really seeing the second and third generations. And I would say I know quite a few that are finding their voice. Some are in mainstream media, still nowhere near enough. Right. So obviously that's a massive difference with the UK. When it comes to gender, I mean, there's issues there as well. You know, I would say when it comes to inclusion in general, Italy's probably what we would call a little, you know, behind in many ways. So, yeah, there's more of an issue there. But objectivity around journalism, I would still say, was the biggest difference between the two.
What is that one thing that you will change about the media industry?
Oh, gosh, I just, you know, there's so many changes now, right now. That's the thing. And it's one of the, if you had told me when I started 22 years ago, actually, that I would have left a job as a news anchor for a major international news TV channel, I would have told you you were crazy. Mm. You know, but then I did, and it made perfect sense. So I think there's enormous changes in the media right now. Everyone's trying to figure out which way things are going. I will say, even as someone that's left mainstream news gathering to do things that are a little bit more, you know, more my own thing, I will say there's nothing that replaces reporters on the ground getting the facts. Because mm-hmm. Everyone can write an opinion piece. Who's in Ukraine getting the information? Who's getting the footage? You know, the pictures that prove what is happening, where propaganda is everywhere. So I don't think I'm going to change the media industry because it's changing enough on its own. But I would say just always remember that there's no substitute for journalism. Sure, TikTok, Instagram, whatever. Substack newsletter, great. Who is getting the information? Mm. Who's doing the reporting?
What's next for you?
For me? Oh, gosh. I think more of what I've been doing. So more focus on, like I said, the two issues. I'm writing a book right now on fascism. Based on the film I made, Fascism in the Family. And so I'm looking, and again, how, you know, language affects the different narratives around it. Unfortunately, the rise of the far right doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. So it's unfortunately still topical, both my film and the issue. And again, so it's kind of focusing on these two issues and then using my broadcasting experience or writing. I love writing to highlight both. And then we'll see. We'll see.
I want to close this interview with something hopeful and positive.
Oh, we've been hopeful and positive
I know,
and inspiring.
Let's be
we haven't been depressing.
Let's be even more. So what are you most hopeful about for the future of journalism?
Oh, gosh. Al Jazeera was all about bringing the voice of the global south, for example. Now, I don't want to be too optimistic and think, oh, look, we changed the world. And certainly Al Jazeera, you know, is a massive news organization. But I do think that since the launch of Al Jazeera in 2006, there has been more balance where you do also hear voices from the global south and not always filtered by the sort of Western media. And it's not Western, it's sort of Anglophone. So it's usually UK and the US. And so I think what I hope, because I think it's happening anyway, and social media helps in that, is just to hear more. I just want to hear more voices. You know, I'm not taking anything away from how good the sort of Western media organizations are. I just like to hear more voices. Now, you always have to bear in mind that in a lot of places in the global south, there is no free press. Mm-hmm. So let's, you know, when we say hear voices, I don't want to hear more government voices.
No.
Yeah, that would be my hope. And I do think, I don't know, don't want to be overly optimistic, but I do think there's more of that now.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara, for this conversation. Again, it was an honor to have you here, and we're going to keep following you in this new adventure. Please subscribe to her Substack newsletter.
News with a foreign accent.
News with a foreign accent. And from two Italians in the UK, bye.
Arrivederci.